Welcome to the Leader, Manager, Coach podcast, where we share knowledge, philosophies, wisdom, and insight to help you on your journey in both sport and life. Introducing your host, Rob Riles.
Hello and welcome to the Leader Manager Coach podcast. Welcome along. It's Rob Riles welcoming you to another program. Now, today I'm extremely fortunate. I've got somebody with me all the way from across the pond in the United States of America. This lady is a renowned author. She's a keynote speaker. She's a self-confessed brought up via the School of Hard Knocks, and has forged a very successful career out of helping other people, to put it quite simply. She's an expert in human behavior and is sought after as a speaker. And I'd like to introduce to you listeners on Leader Manager Coach, Jacqueline Wales, author of The Success Factor. And she will perhaps tell us a little bit about her subsequent work as well. So Jacqueline, welcome to Leader Manager Coach.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here and to connect once more with my homeland, because as you know, I was born in Edinburgh. So, you know, it's the uniting of the global thing. It's great.
Well, thank you for joining us. And hopefully for about the next 40 minutes, I might be able to pick your brains and get some value for our listeners. So what would really help, and I found really helps, is look, just if you would just lay the stage about how you kind of became interested in what it is that you do, and a little bit about your background would be really great, Jacqueline, to start.
So as I just mentioned, I was born in Scotland and Edinburgh, but I lived there only for the first 16 years of my life. And there was a good reason for that, because I grew up in a household that didn't particularly nurture the children in the house. And there was a lot of alcoholism and violence and so forth. I mean, typical working class family. And my expectations, or the expectations for me, was I was going to go work in the factory. That was it. But at 16, I knew that that was not it. There was something else. And so I set off on a journey, I would say. And if you've ever read Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey, which is pretty significant, that's kind of how it is. I mean, I'm 71 years old now. And so, you know, I look at the decades of the experiences I've gathered and the traveling that I've done. So I went literally from Edinburgh to London, and I spent a few years in London, made a lot of mistakes in London, getting pregnant, getting married, getting divorced, having children, leaving children, blah, blah, blah. It's a long story. I could take up 40 minutes just telling you about that. And then I moved to San Francisco in 1979. And I've always been showing up with, I didn't know anybody, didn't have a job, didn't have any reason to really be there, but I managed to make it work. So I ended up in San Francisco and I met my husband, who I've now been with for 43 years. So we've had, you know, a lot of ups and downs, but we're still here. We're still doing it. After San Francisco, moved to Los Angeles for quite a few years. Then it was Paris, France, and then Amsterdam, then New York. And then finally back to the San Francisco Bay Area again. And in between, I had a house in Bali for 17 years. So this is my global experience right there. But what has driven a lot of what I've done was a search for meaning. Now, we talk about man's search for meaning. Viktor Frankl talks about that. What is your purpose in life? What are you doing to make a difference in life? And for me, a lot of it was self-exploration. It was I had to get down to the roots of my fears, my anxieties, my insecurities, my lack of belonging, because having left home at a very early age, there's never a place where you feel like you truly belong. And people would say to me, where's home? And I would say, where my clothes are. So, you know, that was a big piece of it, because I was never in one place. Truly, like, you know, many people live in the same place for 30 years, 40 years or whatever. I can't even imagine a life like that because I've never lived it. But I have had decades of staying in one place, but not often. I think I can point to maybe two examples of that in my lifetime. But the point being is the search for self became an overriding piece for me, because I had a lot of alcohol and drug addictions going on. I had a lot of really self-abusive behaviors. And I had given my first child up for adoption. I'd left the second one with his father. And by the time the third one came along with my current husband, I said, I've got to figure myself out. I've got to stay. I've got to make sure that she leaves me before I leave her. And that meant she would go to college. So I started doing the heavy lifting. And that became an exploration of fear. And what does fear do to you? And fear is fundamentally an emotion that affects every single individual. But here's what I've discovered. Fear is the stories that you tell yourself. Fear is nothing to do with reality. It has everything to do with the narrative that you create for your life. So if you think you're no good, then you're no good. If you think that you're not capable, then you're not capable. However, that's the untruth. That is not the truth of who you are. Because the stories that you create for yourself are usually driven by previous experiences that have informed you to think this way. So we talk about negative thinking, for instance. You know, how many times you call yourself stupid? How many times do you tell yourself, I can't? How many times do you make up the stories about what people are thinking about you? And let's face it, most people aren't thinking about you because they're too busy thinking about themselves. So, you know, there's that piece to it. You know, how much time do you spend looking for approval and validation of who you are? I spent an enormous amount of time asking in subtle and not so subtle ways, am I okay? Because I didn't feel okay. And because I couldn't understand that the strength that was in me, and it clearly was a strength having left home at 16 and done all the things that I'd done pretty much on my own without support, I didn't really understand that until much, much later on. And the children were really the reason why I decided that I had to clean up my shit. And, you know, years of therapy, coaching, workshops, programs, you name it, I've done it all. But the whole soul thing was find out who you truly are. And that became at a later point in my life. And I had a pretty privileged period of life, thanks to my husband. That all changed in the 2000s, probably around 2008. And I decided that I needed to find a profession. I never had one. I was a singer. I was a writer. I had traveled the globe. I'd raised my family. I didn't want for anything, in fact, during that period of time. Probably about 26 years or so. But then everything collapsed. We lost everything. And I was faced with, you better figure out how to make a living. And somebody said, you'd make a really great coach. Well, I've been giving advice all my life. You know, people saying, what do you think? I'd give them my 10 cents worth, you know. And then she said to me, you get paid for that. And I was like, whoa, I get paid for giving advice? I'll take it. So I learned how to become a coach. But more importantly, she said, I want you to start writing, because I'd already written a book called When the Crow Sings, and it was based on family history, semi-autobiographical, three generations of women giving of marriage and the impact it had as it spread from generation to generation. What happened with that was my grandmother had two children, my mother had two children, and I, of course, had two children that I'd left behind. And I wanted to explore that. So I wrote a book called When the Crow Sings. It's written in Scottish transliteration, and it got very good reviews. People really seemed to resonate with it. And then, of course, as I said, came into the coaching business, and my coach said, I want you to write about fear because you know it intimately. And I said, yes, I do. I understand why we create these stories. I understand what it is we do to ourselves when we create those stories. So I wrote The Fearless Factor. The Fearless Factor was the first nonfiction book. And I started talking to women specifically about their fears, because women are notorious for undermining themselves and invalidating themselves and not taking full ownership of who they are. So my career really began with working with women. And it evolved from there. And then eventually I wrote another book called The Fearless Factor at Work. And that was really addressing mid-level managers who had to develop their self-awareness and their communication skills and understand how their fear was impacting their careers. And then, of course, on top of that, I created a program called Transformational Strategies for Success, which is designed to really elevate people to understand who are you, where do you want to go, what is it that matters to you, and what is it that's getting in the way. So it's a highly immersive, self-reflective program, lots of questions that really get people to confront the truth of who they are. And it's powerful. Okay. So okay. That's the entire trajectory to date right now.
Okay. So just so I don't forget, Jacqueline, because I want to make sure I've got your contact details for anybody who wants to look at your website, and I'll put those on the bio when it's published. But just so I don't forget, your transformational strategies, is that an online tool or is that...
It is. It's an online self-directed program. And it's supported by coaching if people decide to want to work with me one-on-one as well. But primarily it's self-directed and it's pretty immersive and very, very deep. There's 11 strategies in there. And the people who have completed this program, Rob, surprised even me in terms of the results. I just got an email last week that said, "You changed my life." Mm-hmm. And I was astounded. I was like, well, I've heard this before, but she said, no, you really changed my life, because I'd understood that I had generalized anxiety disorder and I could never have come to that conclusion or gone for help if I hadn't done your program.
Yeah,
and I, you know, you listen to that and you kind of get gobsmacked. You know, you go, you have no idea when you create stuff, what impact it's going to have for the people that it touches.
Yeah.
And you hope that it's going to be the right kind.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure. So listening to your very succinct story, which you put into a few minutes, it seems to me that your work is, you've lived your work. So you haven't come into something, been taught it and regurgitated it. It sounds to me like you are the real deal, because you've been through the fire, you've been through the forge, you know what it feels like, you know the desperation, you know the losing it all, you know the abuse, you know the, crikey, I can't even put myself there, I am a father myself, and I can't even put myself there of having to give up a child. So, you know, it sounds like you've been through all this, and therefore that qualifies you in, look, it's only my opinion, but it qualifies you totally to be the person that leads others through it, in comparison to somebody who understands it intellectually but doesn't understand it emotionally because they've not lived it.
That's correct? Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I like to say I come from lived experience. I mean, I've read the books. I've never taken a program. I have no PhD. I got as far as a BA in history back in London when I back in the 70s. But this is all based on lived experience. I know what this stuff looks and feels like, and I know how ugly it gets. And I also know that you can get to the other side of it, because my philosophy is being fearless is not the absence of fear, but it's the courage to take the next step. And when we take the next step, what we find is that fear is actually a driver for success. Because when we question our fears, when we stop for a moment and go, is it true? Whatever story you're telling yourself, you know, I won't, I can't, or whatever it is it true? Do you have evidence? And if the answer is no, then that's just shit you made up. Mm. And why did you make that up? Because it somehow confirms your worldview of where things are, you know. So changing that worldview, changing that point of view about who you think you are, and how you put yourself out into the world. That became my personal work, but it's also the work I do mostly with my clients, because I want women specifically to take more ownership and authority in the world. And there's not enough doing it.
Yeah.
And whether it's socialization or whether it's just simply the deep insecurities that come from whoever you are and your experiences, but we can overcome it for sure.
Jacqueline, you talked already to me about you mentioned it there, the word truth, and asking if something's true. Look, I'm a believer that truth is something that people often think that they are truthful, and they're probably not. And I don't mean that they go out there way to lie to people. And obviously there are some people who do that, but I'm talking more about the deception for ourselves personally. Now, what's your take on that? Because I think we tell ourselves all kinds of untruths and we kind of accept them without even questioning. And I think that's what you've just alluded to. Is that something you can just expand on a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, self-deception is there for everybody. You know, we build the walls around ourselves in order to protect ourselves. That's what self-deception is really all about. I feel like I'm keeping myself safe. So the lack of truth about self is based on the belief systems that we've built over a lifetime, you know, and probably started with somebody else's belief systems, to be honest. You heard stuff and you thought, well, that sounds like it should be right. And then you start living by somebody else's idea of what's right. And then it becomes your story. And so when you reveal to yourself that that's not really your story, which is what transformational strategies is all about, when you can reveal to yourself that these stories you tell yourself are really not the truth of who you are, then you have to face where you've been avoiding, where you've been resisting, where you've been blaming other people for what you don't have in your life, as opposed to where you've taken responsibility for your own stuff. So that's really what the self-deception piece is all about. Yeah. It's that, you know, I'm putting up a wall around me to keep myself safe.
So, look, you're talking about that, and maybe, because we talked about this before we came on air, that like the precursor to change can be chaos and or tragedy or ultimate pain that we need to change. So maybe the first step is recognizing that we are deceiving ourselves in some way. And then we have to make changes. So here's your transformational strategies workshop or whatever the agency of change is that, that we choose. But you talked about actually going on physical journeys yourself. You know, you listen to your biography, you've been on journeys yourself. But let's just use the analogy of a journey to change, because it's not the journey can be a journey into away from hell, if you like, and then you kind of in you don't reach the promised land within 2 days, do you, Jacqueline?
No. I mean, I like to say that I can help people get into the change process faster than they would have thought possible. Most people think it takes years to change. It doesn't. It only takes getting honest with yourself. When you can take the space and take the challenge of being honest with yourself. And that means, here's what people say, I'm looking for answers. And I say, you're not looking for answers. You're looking for really good questions. Because it's the questions that unlock the doors. And that's what my programs are all about. I have over 300 questions in my program. So, you know, that's the where I approach it. But to your point, chaos is really the fertile ground. I just wrote about this recently in an article, actually. But if we look at chaos as being the foundation for creativity, because who wants to hang about in chaos? I used to call myself a chaos junkie years ago. If things got too steady, I was like, you got to go mess it up. And that was my life for a long time. Now I see chaos as a positive force, because even if you go back to biblical terms, you know, in the beginning, there was chaos and out of chaos came order. And we as human beings are always striving for order. We want to make sense of our worlds. So we have our cognitive dissonance, as they call it, you know, where you make up your own idea of what that reality really is, you know, and then you work against it, kind of thing. So there is a piece here where chaos is good. It drives you to a point where you go, and we've all been there, your back's against the wall. What are you going to do? Just going to, you know, lie down and take it? Or are you going to get up and fight? Are you going to get up and pivot? Are you going to create a different reality for yourself? Are you going to be brave enough to say, this isn't working, let's try something else? Because one of the reasons, and I'll just segue into this for a moment, one of the reasons people don't want to change is because they're afraid it won't work. They're afraid of failure. Well, what if it doesn't work? Well, what if it did? Well, then my life would change. Yeah, and what would you get out of it? Well, you got a point. Okay. So what will it take for you to make that shift from the chaos that you're currently occupying into something that has a little bit more order to it? Now, we can take the order to extremes. Everything needs to be lined up a specific way. That's a control issue. Control is a fallacy too. None of us have any control. You know, and I like to say that the only reality is this one that we're living in right this second, because what we were talking about 2 minutes ago is already in the ether. It's on the recording, but don't ask me what I said because I can't tell you. And 5 minutes from now, I have no idea where this conversation is going to go. So right now is our only reality. This is it. The tangible piece of our life is the moment you're inhabiting. Now, all the meditation teachers and everything else tell you the same story, but that's it. So when we look at life from that point of view, what is happening right now? And what can I control? And what can I do differently? These become driving questions right there.
Yeah. And I think, Jacqueline, that people think, okay, yes, it's chaos, but I don't want other people to know it's chaos. And I look on social media and everybody else seems to be okay and nobody's complaining. So I'll just say things are okay. And sometimes we have to keep going through different levels of chaos before it gets bad enough for us to actually admit, I am failing at this. I'm not actually making this work. Something has to change. And I think I'm going back over the same thing, but that's the untruth that we realize that we're telling ourselves, isn't it?
Well, I think what you're speaking to, especially if you're looking at social media, is the illusion of success. People are out there being pretty, doing their thing. You know, we're all doing great. Yeah. Let's get underneath that and really find out. I mean, you know, people would look at me and go, you're hugely successful because the public perception is that, but they have no idea what's going on in my background. They have no idea what kind of issues I have to deal with. So again, if we're going to bare our soul, and I've been, you know, been applauded for this for many years now about, you're very transparent, you're very honest about what's going on. And I go, well, what other way is there to be? Because if I spin you a story about, oh, everything's hunky-dory, then that's not the truth. And if I reveal the truth, am I revealing that I'm somehow weak? Am I somehow incompetent? Am I somehow not worthy? No, what you're revealing is that you're vulnerable. And a lot of people respect vulnerability because you know yourself when you hear these stories of, you know, catastrophes and people coming back from them. We have nothing but admiration because a lot of us feel like, wow, I wish I could do that. I wish I could have the courage to do that. Well, the courage is within all of us. Mm. It just depends on how far you're willing to get comfortable being uncomfortable in order to make the changes.
Yeah, absolutely. What have you, the answer to this is probably yes, but have you been in the place where you thought, do you know what, I'm done. I'm absolutely done. And can you remember the tenuousness of that situation? Because look, you know, we have in football at the minute, we have the big thing in the men's football world at the minute is mental health, because there are more men between the ages. I don't know what the exact ages are. I think it's between 18 and 65. The death. It's more through suicide than anything else. That's horrendous. That is a horrendous statistic in the Western world. So in terms of mental health, let's just surmise a very broad brush statement that people take their lives when they think it's a hopeless situation. So I'm kind of asking you brutally, can you remember that for you?
Oh, for sure. Many times you just sat there and went, you know, I don't know if I can continue. I don't know if this is worth it. And especially in the deepest, darkest parts of my transformational process, I really felt like, you know, is this worth it? Mm. Well, at the stage of the game, absolutely it was worth it. But I have been in that place. Mm. I can point to it recently where I looked at what I was doing and I was like, really? Is this all there is? Is this it? Mm. And then you have to grab a hold of yourself and go, hell no. You can change this if you want to. But for people who commit suicide, they're not seeing anything but blackness. They're not seeing any way out of that particular malaise. And I agree with you. Mental health, especially for men at this point in time, is critical all over the Western world. Might be all over the globe. I don't know. Because the standards are changing. You know, there's more women coming into leadership roles now than ever before. There's more women who are really willing to step up and take charge. And somehow, for many men, that's very threatening. Mm. You know, it's like there's traditional roles of where women are supposed to be. And I'm certainly not a supporter of that. Women demand and need to be where they want to be and do whatever it is that they want to do. Now, we get caught up in the traditions of, you know, women as mother, woman as caretaker, woman as nurturer, etc. Doesn't preclude all of that, not by a long shot, but I think there is more of that stepping into the more type senior roles where women really are taking control of companies, see more women in government. You know, there's a lot more going on. But for men, I think there's really a challenge at this point in time, and I think we need to start addressing it. I've been looking at the numbers too, and it's quite shocking the amounts of suicides that's going on around the world at this stage. So what is that about? Well, it's because I can't see any other way out.
Yeah.
And nobody's there to help them. Nobody's there to say, you can think differently. Mm. You can be different. And here's your choices. And like when people say to me, well, I don't have a choice in the matter, we always have a choice. And when you say, I don't have a choice, you just made a choice.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. We have it, look, being involved in the professional football world, we have many young men who live the ultimate dream life according to, you know, the standards of many young boys and people in this country. They are multimillionaires at young ages. They have the choice of whatever female they want, and they play their favorite sport for a living, you know. And looking from the outside into a young mind, it's, you know, it's everything. It's the perfection. And yet we have a plethora of, underneath it, absolutely lost, devastated young men who are drip feeding out about their own mental states and the problems that they've got, Jacqueline. And your story, the through line through your philosophy, if I can be that kind of succinct about it, yes, it's fear, but you talk very eloquently about the discovery of yourself as the solution, or part of the solution, to dealing with all these emotions and the negativity and the fear. And I think that having to conform and be a certain way, and absolutely certainly not showing any vulnerability, because you show vulnerability in a professional football environment, you are risking everything. And there's a lot of rhetoric at the moment about that having to change. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing here for American sports as well. We're seeing more athletes speaking about mental health and the struggles they've gone through. And let's face it, if you hand a young person, a shitload of money and the freedom to do and whatever it is that they please, they're going to squash down whatever insecurities they might be feeling because they've got to appear like they're totally in control. They're successful, and the success is measured by how much money's in the bank, what kind of car they drive, what kind of house they live in, and what kind of woman they've attracted into their life. That's the measurement right there. But that's not the measure of the person. That's just simply the measure of circumstances. So when you take the measure of the person, or you ask that person to take a measure of themselves, that then becomes the important piece. Because imagine who you're going to be. Like, 25, you're at the height of your career, you're making those goals, you're doing a tremendous job, you're getting amazing accolades from everybody about how brilliant you are. And inside, you're dying because you haven't been able to be honest with yourself about what really matters to you. Because frankly, you don't know because you're too busy focusing on all the stuff that's out there. We'll just shove it aside for now. And then you wake up 20 years later and you go, what happened? That's when the desperation sets in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you put it so well. And it's interesting, obviously I don't keep up with American sports so much, but it's interesting that it's happening, on both sides. Look, you in your book, you talk about family. Well, I didn't know this till I spoke to you before we came on air about your own family situation. And I love your, you've obviously been honest. You just talked about vulnerability 30 seconds ago, and you told me, about your own family situation, and it's not something I can relate to because, touch wood, I didn't have that kind of alcohol and stuff going on in my home just for a start, So the reason I'm asking you this question is in my work, I work with young people who they come from, some come from a background where their working mum gives them the bus fare to get on a bus to come to training. Others turn up in an £80,000 car that both parents are sitting in, and they've got all the kit. If I listen to your story, your upbringing can be overcome no matter what it is. And maybe having everything is not actually the best platform. So anything you can just pad that out a bit from your own experience and your work.
Well, I would say, having everything. I mean, I have a his, mine, and ours family. Okay, so my son was born to my ex-husband in England. Okay, he was raised in England by his father, and he now lives in Brighton, and he's got family of his own with a 7-year-old daughter, and we talk every weekend. So, but the journey for us to get there was long, and it could take up a whole other few minutes telling you that one. But the two girls that we raised, and he came with one from his side too, because he had a daughter born in Thailand. And at the age of 10, she came to California to live with us. And I was a complete stranger to her because he had never introduced us in all the years that we had been together because of mother, and there's a whole complicated story there. But the point being is that I have a stepdaughter and I got a son. And they are like, out there. But the stepdaughter came to live with us. But the two girls that I gave birth to, ours, they were raised with a tremendous amount of privilege. Tremendous amount of privilege. Private schools, global travels, whatever. You had the whole thing going on. Now, that's all well and good. But I'd like to say that what I also instilled in them was a sense of practicality. That they weren't just going to say, I want, and they got. That didn't happen. But when I look at them now, and they're all adults at this stage, my oldest is 48, my youngest is 32. So, you know, I look at them now and I go, okay, so what are you doing? Well, one's an executive pastry chef. She's the youngest one. She works super hard. Anyone who works in a restaurant will tell you that. That is one of the hardest jobs in the world to do. And the other one is a very successful software engineer and has made gobs of money that, you know, I was making 200 bucks a week at her age. And she's, you know, buying multi-million dollar homes. Hello, you know. So there's a privilege piece here, but I think they're also very practical people and they don't take anything for granted. In fact, if anything, I got accused of spending way too much money on stuff I didn't need, which is probably true because I never had money. And when you get it, you kind of, you know, I know this story. You go and you buy all kinds of shit that you really don't need, but you buy it anyway because you can. And they're the exact opposite. It's like frugal to you know, a T. So I don't think privilege and growing up in a privileged background is really an indicator of how well that individual will turn out
No,
in
no.
terms of, you know, the entitlement. Because I think that's what you're really addressing here is when you grow up with privilege, are you entitled? There's a certain see it in some of my kids, certainly not in my son. But there's one in particular I can think of who really thinks that the world revolves around her. But that's her, you know. But overall, I would say that's, and again, the educational part. I'm an explorer. I took my kids to therapy when they were 6 years old because we were having problems. And I couldn't figure out how to handle it because it was all my stuff that was getting in the way. And so we went to therapy. And the kids tell me, I credit that, and we did it maybe three or four times throughout their growing up, for various reasons. But they say I credit that for the fact that we're fairly stable people. Yeah. So there you go. That's the story on my family.
Well, you have a longevity to back that up. Look, Jacqueline, it seems as if this has flown, and I'm very, very conscious of your time. I'm going to certainly recommend that anybody who wants to find out more about this goes to your transformational strategies and checks that out. If not, picking up the book as a starter from Amazon or from wherever they want to get it from. Look, your story's beautiful on its own. You've put together some great works. The last thing I want to ask you about, and this is mainly for the coaches who listen to this, and maybe people who are getting a little bit older, not so much the youngsters, but you talked about your extensive work with middle managers, and maybe the word overwhelm. It is something that's resonant there, because would you say that people are on this treadwheel of success that they think is the thing to do, and that overwhelm is an issue? I can relate to being overwhelmed trying to achieve things. Is that something that
Oh, yeah. I
you
mean, I think, you know, anyone who's a high achiever will get overwhelmed. Anyone who's a high achiever will take on far more than they really need to at any given time. I mean, think about it. Make a list of all the things you want to do, and I guess, yeah, I'll bet you it's a page long. Well, let's try to reduce that. You know, I'm very capable of like, you know, here's my tactics for the day. And at the end of the day, did you get it all done? No, you didn't. Well, look at the amount of phone calls you had in between, so you couldn't really focus on that particular aspect of things. So we have to shorten the list in order to stop ourselves from being overwhelmed. Now, when you're working for a company that says do, 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 do all day long, and you're looking at it and going, well, where's the resources for that? You know, it's again, I'll go back to my daughter who's got one assistant in a kitchen. She works for a small, well, not even a small, a boutique hotel, and she needs another assistant. Are they going to pay for another assistant? No, they don't want to. They want her just to continue. So she comes home every night exhausted. So the overwhelm is real. So you yourself have to figure out how to set some boundaries. And here's the big secret to this. People are not very good at saying no. People find it really hard to get those two little letters and say, no, that doesn't work for me. Because the fear is, well, if I say it doesn't work for me, they're going to tell me there's the door, get lost, you know. But until people start doing that, until people start taking some control back,
control
their time and the circumstances that they're surrounding themselves with, overwhelm will continue to be an issue. And that leads to depression, that leads to problems with mental health, that leads to burnout. And the figures for burnout in both the UK and America at this point in time is stratospheric, because people are being asked to do a lot more with less. And we have to be able to say no. We have to figure out how to say no and be okay with that. Because the fear of saying no is, I'm going to lose my job, I'm going to lose my respect, I'm going to lose whatever. But what you gain is far more in self-esteem.
Beautiful. Jacqueline, like, less is more, and taking control and controlling the things we can and being courageous enough to use those two little words so that we can do the best in our space. I think that's a pretty good place, as sad as it is and such a small bit of your brain, to leave it, so that I can be respectful of your time, which I've already had, you know, nearly an hour. So listen, it's been amazing. I really wish I could have you for like another hour at least, because I've got like 50 things on my list. But I'm so grateful for being able to connect with you. So I just want to say a big thank you. And it's just lovely to connect. And I'm very privileged, feel very privileged to connect with such a successful lady and to have an hour of your time. So thank you ever so much.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be here. And if anybody wants more information, just go to JacquelineWales.com. Very simple. It's all there. We'd love to hear from you.
Bless you. Thank you very much, Jacqueline. It's been a pleasure.